SES. Welcome to the Science of Getting Rich podcast. I'm your host, Gerald Peters. Always remember, folks, whatever you think about comes about, and whatever you focus on grows. Hope you're doing well. We're into February. My birthday's in February. Kind of sucks having your birthday on Valentine's Day. That's my birthday, and throughout my life, you know, especially in your teenage years and your early 20s, you're constantly buying your girlfriend a gift on your birthday. It sucks. It's like having your birthday on Christmas. You get cheated, man. But so it is. I used to use it to my advantage to squash Valentine's Day. I'd be like, look, it's my birthday. I'm not buying you anything on Valentine's Day. I just want you to know that. And it worked every time. And I got out of the trouble of ever having to buy Valentine's gifts. That's probably terrible, right? But you have to use what you have, where you are, to get what you need to get, right? As United States Marines say, adapt and overcome. Something I became, if you ever spent any time in the military, and you don't have to be in the military to do this, but for me, I imagine being in prison would teach these things, or any environment where you're kind of having to hustle to stay ahead, and there's a lot of things that can get you, and the Army's like that. And so I had to learn to use what I had to get where I needed to be. And the major lesson that I learned in the Army, I mean, you learn a lot of things, but one of the lessons that stuck with me, has stuck with me my entire life, I had a first sergeant, had a huge influence. He was my first sergeant. He was first older man that was, I don't know, he was late 30s at the time, and he was a good dude, and I kind of looked at him as a father figure. I mean, he was a stern father figure in that he was a sergeant first class in the United States Army, combat engineers, but he was a fair man, and he was consistent. You knew what you were getting with him, and so it was fair. And when you know what you're getting and when you understand the rules, you can begin to actually play the game and actually become good at it. And he taught me this valuable lesson that it's always easier to say you're sorry than to ask permission. He'd say, Gerald, or Private Peters, it's always easier to say you're sorry than to ask permission. In other words, that when you come and you ask people, hey, could I do this? You open up a whole line of objections. And so by simply just taking the initiative, taking the action, if you get it right, you get praise. And if you don't, you can just say, I'm sorry. My fault. One of the other things he taught, not so much just him, but he definitely was central in my life, was this idea of taking full responsibility. I include it now in my business that I run, entitled the Downline Building Network. We're a lead broker organization. We sell leads to people in the network marketing industry. And one of the principles that I teach, I try to teach my customers, my staff, is this idea of what I call pillar number 10 in the 10 pillars of success. And pillar number 10 is to take full responsibility for everything that happens. Doesn't matter if it was your fault or not, you assume responsibility. That's what being a leader is all about. I witnessed the opposite of this after I left the Army, where leadership is assuming responsibility for equipment and for other people's lives when you're a leader. You know, a sergeant ate last. He would eat after his troops ate. He would shower after his troops shower. His responsibility was to his soldiers and bringing them home, not to himself. The best way he could advance his career is by serving other people. And what I experienced when I left the Army, you know, luckily I had this at such a young, ripe age, but when I left it, I didn't experience that anymore. There weren't people falling on the sword, you might say, to take up. And I did some time where I worked in a juvenile correctional facility. I worked in adult corrections, and it was people looking out for themselves, not only the inmate, but the other correctional officers and the staff. And if anything went wrong, the state didn't look to defend their employees. They looked to punish their employees. And so it was a different kind of environment. And it's quite dysfunctional. The state of Texas, the prison system, has a horrible reputation. And it's truly because of the idiots who run it are civilians. And they've never understood what it means to be a leader. But they understand what it means to be a boss. And being a boss means you tell people what to do. Being a leader is you tell people what to do and then you assume the responsibility for them doing it. And so it's a little bit more of an intimate relationship, and their failure to act is your failure first. And so the captain goes down with his ship, right? Well, in the free world, as they call it, or in the civilian world, this world that we live in and I've lived in for now for a long time, it's a different world. It's kind of a dog-eat-dog world. People are out for themselves. There's very few situations where people are truly leaders. There's a lot of bosses. I know a lot of people that have employees, and they don't really consider themselves as leaders. Now, part of the problem is, to be a leader, you have to have people who want to follow. And so if you're trying to lead someone who doesn't want to follow, that's not a proper relationship, and it doesn't work. And the difference is, in the military, there are people who are there voluntarily, and they want to follow. And then after they've followed long enough and they've been trained, they raise their hand and say, I would like to lead now. And sometimes the Army pushes you in that direction. They say, we like you, son. We like you. You do a good job. Here's some corporal stripes. We're now going to ask a couple things of you. Because you can get away with a lot of shit when you're a private. A lot of mess ups, a lot of mistakes, because they blame the higher ups. When you mess up as a private, sure enough, you get yelled at, maybe even get punished a little bit. But I promise you, your sergeant and the chain of command above him is equally punished. And so you develop this more intimate relationship of lead and follow. And when that cohesiveness breaks down, the military isn't very effective. And we saw this in the military after the Vietnam War. You didn't have a lot of people who wanted to be there. And it's extremely hard to lead an army of people who've been drafted. You need volunteers. The NFL works because the men there volunteer to play, and they each are seeking to do the best they can in the position they've been given. And the teams that do the best, such as the Patriots, you may or may not even know many of the players' names. And yet you know individual players on other teams. Why? Because they're showboats, and I'm sure enough they're talented without a doubt. But it's about them, and it's not so much about the team. Tom Brady was taken in the NFL draft at like number 180. Why? Because he was a team player. He wasn't an individual star. And so in that team of the Patriots, if you dig into it and understand how it works, it's a lead-follow kind of thing. They have an intimate relationship where each person takes full responsibility for their position. They're not trying to push the buck and say, well, that's not my job. It's one of the dumbest comments. I hear that all the time. They used to drive me crazy. When I first left the Army and was working for the state of Texas, the juvenile correction facility, everyone was constantly saying, well, that's not my job. That's not my job. That's not my job. And I realized real quick, all I had to do to move up in this organization is just make everything my job. Now, some staff didn't like that. They say, what are you doing? This ain't your job. It is now. And I began to run that place like I owned it. I've been there about 3 months working as a juvenile correctional officer, one. Lowest level, low pay, but they had insurance and I was going to college. Now, I realized that I was smarter than a lot of the people that work there. And I don't mean that braggadociously. I've just always had good street smarts. My mind works fast. I'm able to find arbitrage. And I don't have a college degree or any permits, but I'm able to think fast. I'm able to take what's around me, what's in front of me, and utilize it to the best of my ability. I'm able to take other people's time, talent, and treasuring, help them utilize it that would benefit them and me. And I understood these concepts of leadership. And I said, well, here's what I'll do. I'm just going to assume responsibility for everything on this unit, to include a lot of the things my boss does. I'm going to do it better, faster, sooner, and quicker, and without being asked. And I began to come to work 20 minutes, 30 minutes early. I began to stay 20 minutes, 30 minutes late. I began to do things the next day that weren't even asked to be done. And here's what happens. It actually caused some problems at work. It was a shakeup. People would literally say things to me like, yo, man, don't do that. They'll expect us to do that all the time. And I said, you should do it all the time. This unit doesn't perform at its highest level. How can we make more money? How can we do well? How can we actually do our job and our mission if we're all performing at a substandard level? See, there were no people that I was, well, I shouldn't say there weren't none, because some did rise up, but there were no people exercising their right to be rich. Science of Getting Rich teaches this idea that you're born with this right, much like a divine right, much like a king having right. You're born with that title, but being born to a title doesn't make you into a great king. You have to earn that part. And when people don't want to follow the king, they look to remove the king, right? And yet ever so often a king would come along, like King Herod the Great and various kings, where everyone was loyal. He was a different kind of king. He wasn't a boss king. He wasn't a king that ruled by fear. But people willingly followed because under his leadership things were better. This is why it's hard to syrup a sitting president of the United States if the economy's doing well, if everyone's got a little bit more money in their pocket, they're going to overlook all the bad language. They're going to overlook all the little flaws as long as everyone's paying their bills and got a little money in their pocket, because that's what's at the end of the day we all need to eat. We can't eat values. We can't eat ideologies. We have to eat actual money. And if you're doing well and business is doing great, why would you shake that up? And this is why sitting presidents who have good economies tend to stay, and presidents who are going under a negative economy tend to go. And often has no reflection of the man's ability to lead, or because some of these things in the business cycle are out of the president's hands. The president can't single-handedly lift the economy. The president can't single-handedly do anything. It's only with his ability to lead. And unfortunately, to lead, you've got to have people who want to follow. And yet in our country, much like the state of Texas and their idiotic prison system, we have a bunch of congressmen and senators who want to be showboats, who want to be standouts for the right and the left. They don't want to follow. So it doesn't matter who the king is or his character if there's no one to follow him. And those kingdoms crumble. And it'll always be that way in America, because there's always half the people who don't want to follow. Even if he was a good man, even if his intent was right, even if he was helping us all, there's still half the people that no matter what, no matter the circumstance, will refuse to follow. And an army, soldiers who don't follow, don't win battles. What makes the U.S. Army such a fierce force is we're all volunteers. We're all volunteering to fight for our homeland. So we don't mind coming to your house and kicking your ass, because it keeps you from coming to our house and kicking our ass. Make sense? People say, well, America shouldn't be involved in all these places. And you understand, by being involved there, they can't come here. So you want to take the fight to the enemy. Why? Because you don't want them to destroy your house. And if you're over there fighting, they got to worry about you. They can't come here. Now, is that applicable to today's world as it was in the old days? But no, but in the old days, when you fought with swords and horses, damn sure better take the fight over there before they come here, right? Because if they come here, we lose everything. Our crops, our houses, our buildings, our women, our children, everything's at risk. And so soldiers take the battle to the enemy if you want to win. And this is why there were some people who seem obsessed with conquering and going into the world and destroying places. Like, what are they doing? Because they know the best defense is a strong offense. And you can't come get them if you're too busy protecting yourself. Samurais fight with two swords, no shield. It's pretty fascinating. I'm all into sword fighting, and I don't sword fight, but I mean armies and soldiers who did fight with swords, I find it fascinating. I love anything to do with the Roman Legion, anything with the Middle Ages, anything that was going on in any part of the world where they were fighting hand-to-hand with swords has always fascinated me. I've had this weird fantasy that I would have been a good sword fighter. I'm only 5'10 and only weigh about 190, so I probably wouldn't have been, but in my mind, I'm a 10-foot tall and bulletproof, and I'm really good with a sword. And I've always liked the samurai. See, the samurai, to become a samurai, has to go out on a and be alone. Vikings have a similar thing. Indians had a thing called a walkabout, where you have to separate yourself, leave. You have to be dependent completely on yourself for a period of time, and for samurais, I think it was 12 months. You had to go live in the woods, man, on your own. And during that time, you were to become one with your sword. I mean, the purpose of this separation from society was to train, was to fight. yourself. Work out your own demons. Build up your own self-confidence. Learn to become intimate with your sword and your weapon. And it took about a year. In today's day and culture, people want to do that in a week. Oh, hey, I joined your little business opportunity. When do you think I'm getting paid? You say, well, do you understand how the pay plan works? What is the marketing strategy? Do you understand the big picture? Have you taken in the 10 pillars of success? Have you read the books? Have you read the 24? No. So this fast-paced world of on-demand movies. But see, the samurai had to go and prove that he could live alone for 1 year. Why? Because that means that soldier could be self-sufficient. Now imagine you got an army of dudes that can be self-sufficient, literally with no help, live for an entire year with your hands in the woods. No guns, none of that. Most of us would die. Now imagine you command an army of guys like this. Oh, and they've raised their hand and said, I'll follow. Undying loyalty. Don't question the leadership. The emperor is divine. And the shogun, villages, Japan was broke up into shoguns, led little groups, samurais, and they do battle and war with each other. But the samurai didn't carry a shield. The samurai used two swords because offense is the best defense. And the samurai said he was already dead. See, symbolically, he died when he spent that 1 year in the woods learning to be completely self-sufficient. He died there. To be a samurai is to die to this normal life that everyone else was living. You're no longer a farmer. You're no longer a merchant. You're not simply a husband or a father, but you're a samurai. Samurais chose to follow the shogun who was taken from one of them. He too had spent a year on his own. He too fought with two swords. And so he was their leader. They called him the shogun. And the shogun would pledge his allegiance to the emperor. So we have this clear line of succession, this clear line of who's in charge, who's not. And there is no room in that. Not my job. That's not my job, that's Betty's job. There's no room in there for that. At all. And in business, offense is the best defense. What does it mean to be offense in business? Means to be attacking your customers, figuratively. Well, how do you attack? Do you just thrust your sword forward? Yeah, but no. You might do a forward thrust. You also might swing from the left, right? You might come down. You might kick them. You might fall on top of them and stab them, right? You're trained. Swing this way, swing that way. What am I saying? I mean, there's more than one marketing strategy. And so you're in business, you're promoting something, I hope. Wages are fine. Wages from a job are fine. They're honorable. That's how men take care of their families. That's how women take care of their families. It's honorable. But you don't get rich from wages. You get rich from profits. And profits are made on the side. Profits are made when something's produced and sold. And so you have to be selling something. So in other words, if you are not involved in day-to-day of selling of something, the chances are, truth is, you'll never be rich. The funny thing is, I know how easy it is to get rich in America. I've tiptoed around that. I've tiptoed around. I watched people that I knew. I spent about 10 years of my life dedicated to internet marketing, email marketing. I was an early email marketer and started in 98, 99. You know, and I'd done over $1 million in email sales by 2005. And you say, well, that's not a lot. Look, man, I didn't go to college. I was born in a trailer park in Arkansas. If there's someone in my family that's made over $50,000 a year, I'd be shocked. That's where I'm from. And so for me to have a six-figure year from home, mind-boggling in my family. And along that way, someone gave me a book called The Science of Getting Rich, and I realized there are people in this country who get rich for simply buying the right stock. That's all they did. They made one decision, one time, and then didn't ruin it. Like 10 years ago, every single person listening to this recording could have easily bought shares in Amazon. Easily. You just didn't. So this idea that, well, I can't get rich. How am I not going to? It's all around you. Literally yesterday, there are things you could have done that in 10 years will make you rich. We just don't know what they are. Could be buying a cannabis stock. Imagine if 7 years ago you'd have bought Bitcoin. And I think Bitcoin's dumb, but I'm not stupid. If you'd have bought it 7 years ago, you'd be rich now. That's how simple it is. Think about it. Roll that around in your head. This is how simple it is in America to get rich. One idea. One invention. Piece of property purchased at the right place and you didn't know it would be, but it was. Land that you own that they find an oil well, a lottery ticket. The list is endless of things that could just make you rich. But in order for any of those crazy things like that to happen, you've got to believe in the money flow. You have to tap into this stuff that you know it's conceivable. What you think about comes about, and what you focus on grows. No, if you don't ever look at the stock market or invest or buy things, you're never going to pick the right stock. You're right. 100% locked it in. You're proving it. You never will because you chose not to. Wasn't because you were held back. You can open an account with a stupid cell phone. You can open an account with a cell phone. And some of you listening to me right now haven't. Same spirit that created this universe created me. The same power. This giant life thing that we're in. You never had premonitions like, man, deja vu? Man, all that stuff's connected. I don't know how, but I know it is. Because see, I know that the things I think about come about and the things I think about are focused on growth. I know, because I've seen it happen over and over and over. And here's the funny part is, if it wasn't for my stupid thinking, if it wasn't for me being a dork and thinking, not thinking big enough, 1999, I sat on my porch, clear as day to me. And I was just starting to take all this stuff in. I'm reading these books and I'm starting to apply it. I'm starting to try to believe things. Like if I was to join this opportunity, I was going to create stuff and promote it. And I was going to blog and I'm going to do all these things, right? And I began to believe that these things are even possible. And I sat on my front porch in my little $60,000 house I had bought, and I didn't know how I was going to make the mortgage payment. 1,100 square foot home that's now over 4,000 square feet, two buildings, swimming pool. I just kept building as I made money. But at the time, this tiny little house in this little town in Texas, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, and I said, what do I want? I said, I want 10 houses. I want to make enough money where I could buy 10 rental properties. And I set out and mapped what I wanted. I wanted $100,000 in this account. I wanted this. I wanted that. I wanted, you know, I wanted my own business that I could run from home if I wanted to. I wanted this. And I listed these things. And at the time, they seemed so far away. Impossible. Impossible, to be honest. Within 8 years, I had all of those things. And since I've gotten more, and I realize now, I'm so stupid. I thought so small. Like getting 10 houses is hard. It seemed so hard at the time. And now I realize it's so simple. So simple. And I remember thinking money was so hard. And now I realize you can just ask for it. You could just write the simplest of ads. and just ask for it. And maybe the first ad doesn't work. Maybe the second post doesn't work. Maybe the third thing you did doesn't work. But some work. And when they work, you get rich. And if I told you that a piece of paper or a pencil or writing a slogan or coming up with a 40, for me it was like, for me in network marketing, I'd failed and failed and failed and failed and failed and been in tons of programs. And I'm sitting there in the same porch. And the phrase from one of my mentors had been going around and around in my head. What you think about, you get to keep. What you think, or what you give away, you get to keep. What you give away, you get to keep. What you give away, you get to keep. And I said, what I'm trying to keep is a downline. What if I gave them away? What if I said, hey, join me, and I will mail, I will market, promote, run an ads, whatever I got to do. And I'm going to get, when three people respond, I'm going to give them to you. And then when I give them to you, you join me. And then me and you will go and try to do the same for them. It's not perfect, but it's a strategy. And I began to document it. And I simply wrote it on one piece of paper. On a single piece of paper. And I printed it up, and I looked at it, and I reworded it, and I wrote it, and I kept this thing for a couple months and kept modifying. I said, well, I need a picture on there. And I put my phone number, and I kept putting it on, and I see request free information. And I finally got it together, and I went and bought a mailing list. And I mailed my flyer to 400 or 500 complete strangers, shared my idea and shared my story. And $1,100 came in $20 and $40 bills. $1,100 came in. Of people going, yeah, that sounds good. See, because on my flyer, I had a free option, join for free, request free information. Then I had a $20 upgrade and a $40 upgrade. Didn't think anybody would do them. $1,100 comes in. It would have came in 2 weeks earlier. It would have came in a month before that. It would have came in a year before that and probably 10 years before that. But I didn't ask. Get it? Ask and ye shall receive. See, the best defense is a good offense. The best defense is a good offense. See, when you need money, here's what people do. When you get hard on money and you're not doing well, we start cutting. Oh, I can't spend money on this. So what you do, you start cutting yourself off from the universal money flow. Because now you go into scarcity mode. We got to cut this, got to sell that. Boo, can't do this. It's I can't, won't, can't do, don't have this, can't do this. And here's what people tell me when they're really poor, when they're broke. People that are broke will respond to my ads. And here's what they say to me. I can't do what you're doing because I don't have money to do what you're doing. Now, this is the guy that pulled out a piece of paper and a pencil and wrote down the thing. And it cost me about $100 and something to print the flyers, to buy the mailing list. Probably, I'm $200 in. And I mail them out. And $1,100 comes in. They're telling this guy, well, I can't do that, man. Of course they can't. They've cut themselves off from the money flow. They see it in scarcity. See, they think the best defense is a shield. Shield wall. It's not two swords. See, they didn't do what I did. I spent a year like the samurai wandering the desert, trying to wander in the woods, trying to figure this thing out, man, trying to make it work with what I had, where I was, with what I could do. I can't do, not what I don't have, what I can and what I do have. What is in front of me that as a grown man I can utilize to build my business, take care of my family, and damn it, prosper and get rich. I took a pencil and a piece of paper and have now done, I don't know, 10 million? I don't count. What's the point in counting? Got rid of the ego thing long ago. Something you could probably do too. I talk with people with bigger egos than mine and they're broke. They're calling me how to do business and then kind of almost lecture me. Now, you're not you. I know you're not like that, but I talk to people like that all the time. it's almost as if they're talking down to me. And they call me because they're broke. And then they tell me the things they can't do without even reading my plan or implementing or trying it. They can't implement a new plan because they're broke. And yet the plan is to get them unbroke. Can you? This is where we're at. And the people who cannot afford not to invest, the people who should be doing the minimum of $100 or whatever it is they can scrape together, those people who need it most of all. See, you understand, if you don't have anything, you don't have anything saved, you're not building any wealth, not having it isn't the damn excuse not to do it. Not having something isn't the excuse for not doing it. It's the fuel for why you should do it. Does that make sense? The fact that you're not in shape is the very reason you should get in shape. But people don't go, nah, I'm not in shape enough to go to the gym. I'll wait till I get in shape and then I'll go to the gym. That's dumb. It doesn't, right? That would be dumb. But yet when it comes to money, people will say, yeah, that's good for you. You have money, you can do that. You have money, therefore you can invest. No, the reason you need to invest is because you don't have money. Get it? It's the thing you don't have. The excuse that you give is the very reason you should be doing it. That is the fuel. And until you understand that, until you can get that, nobody can help you. If not having money is the reason you don't start a business, you've got shit twisted in your mind. You got it all wrong. You need to just hold your head underwater. Just keep your head underwater. Because that's about the logic you're making. Just hold your head in there. Because you're making no sense. The fact that you don't have any money is why you should become obsessed with getting rich. The fact that you don't have any business success is the reason you should get obsessed with this stuff. Not the excuse not to do it.